So I realised this morning I'd gone back to the old system, hadn't I? I stopped with O2 Mage Jayamangalam. It's got a certain sort of finality to it. I missed out the new bit, or the bit that's done in India but not here. So a little bit more on the Buddha Vandana, and then we'll look at the Dhamma Vandana. So we've done our initial salutation. We've affirmed who the Buddha is. And then there's been a strong expression of going for refuge to the Buddha, or to Buddhahood, to the Buddhahood throughout time and space. And this strong asseveration at the end, by the virtue of this truth, may, in Bhante's words, grace abound and victory. And then the four-line verse, Uttam Angena Vandeham. Uttam Angena, as I've already told you, is the topmost limb, the head. Vande, that means to salute in the sense of bowing down before. Hung is I. Pada Pangsu, Pada is feet, and Pangsu is dust. So the feet dust, the dust of his feet. Varuttamang, the supreme, the excellent, most supreme individual. Huh? So I bow down with my head at the feet, the dust on the feet of the most excellent, supreme of beings, the Buddha. Huh? So, strongly put, quite sort of emotional almost, is this sense of down at the feet, not just at the feet, but at the dust at the feet. And Varuttamang, the suggestion is of or sort of beyond supreme, very powerful emotional word. And then Buddheyo Kalitodo So, towards the Buddha, any stumbling or wrongdoing that I have committed. So anything that I've done wrong towards the Buddha. Buddho Kamatu Tung Mamang. Which literally means, may the Buddha keep going with me. You know, inevitably, we're going to be, in one way or another, we're sort of breaching our refuge in the Buddha. We see the Buddha as the supreme refuge, but in one way or another, at some time or other, we let that down. We either don't take the Buddha seriously. For instance, we don't take him seriously by seeing him simply as a good human being, not recognising that there's something about him that is beyond the merely human. We let him down by perhaps reacting against him. Sometimes one can even feel some irritation at the Buddha because, well, he's sort of exposing you. Or rather, the idea of the Buddha exposes you. So you're acknowledging that, you're seeing that, and you're, well, the way it's put is that you're asking the Buddha to keep going with you. Well, of course, the Buddha will keep going with you, but you're reconnecting with the Buddha yourself, if you see what I mean. This is the way it's thought of in Buddhism. You don't think of the Buddha as being displeased with you, or far less angry with you, but you, from your side, break the connection. When you cease to see the Buddha as the Buddha, when you cease to act towards the Buddha as if he was the Buddha, when you don't follow his teaching, you create an interference in your own mind with the Buddha. You stop being connected to him, and you need to acknowledge that and reconnect. Sometimes in visualization practice, it's said that the figure appears before you in well-pleased fashion. So you try to feel that the Buddha or Bodhisattva is happy to be with you, wants to be with you. Of course, it's from your side. Of course they want to be with you. But because that's what they're living for, is compassion, is to connect with others. But you, by your actions, break the connection. So you have to sort of reconnect with the Buddha so you can see that he's keeping going with you. Kamatu. That's that connotation of keeping going. So this is very, very important that I've already talked about us needing to see that we are unenlightened, that you can only appreciate the Buddha as enlightened if you recognize yourself as unenlightened. In the same way, you need to realize that because you're unenlightened, you're constantly going to act egotistically. You're constantly going to act unskillfully. You're constantly going to act ignorantly. And so that you're constantly sort of putting a barrier between you and the Buddha from your side. And what you're doing in a verse like this, as you are in the Confession of Faults in the Puja, is acknowledging what it is that stands between you and the Buddha so that it can be cleared away, so that the connection can be restored. So I really like it that this is added to the Buddha Vandana. It's very realistic. You know, we can at times rise to going for refuge to the Buddha and really see who he is, but it's very, very hard to sustain that. You just forget the Buddha. You just start living as if there was no such thing as enlightenment, as if ordinary existence, as if samsara did have within it the possibility of real satisfaction, as if you could create a worldly situation that made you comfortable, made you all right in an enduring way. And you just sort of forget about the Buddha. It was a rather inconvenient sort of denial of everything that's important to us. Put it like that. At least everything that's important to us in a worldly sense. Yes, we need to acknowledge that the fact that we're not able to keep the lines clear. Interference will constantly interfere in the line. And by acknowledging that, we reconnect. We make the connection with the Buddha. We re-communicate with the Buddha. So, yes, you put your head at the Buddha's feet, even the dust on his feet. You recognize that from that point of view, you are... that's where you're worthy of being. And, you recognize that you've made actions of body, speech and mind that interrupt that connection, and you ask the Buddha to keep going with you. Thereby, you get him keeping going with you. A very, very powerful experience. I'm going to talk about this again in the rambles, but I want to share this now because it sort of draws out a bit more this point and a lot of what we've been talking about in the Buddha Vandana. I was very fortunate to spend 2 weeks at Bodh Gaya in November. I went there for two retreats. I had a retreat, I was participating in a retreat for the National Network of Buddhist Youth, about 250 young people from Bodh Gaya and surrounding areas. Very, very poor, horrifying conditions they're living in. And some of our friends from Maharashtra go over there and just round up young Dalits, and we tell them about the Buddha. They have a strong feeling for the Buddha, but they don't know anything about him. So I've started with that. And then I had a retreat for Mitras from North India. It being India, nobody got told about it, so there were only about 60 in a small event. But that had the advantage that, there weren't many people. And so I announced to everybody, I'm not leading this retreat, the Buddha is leading it. And we just went down to the Mahabodhi temple at 6:30 in the morning and stayed there till 1 o'clock. We went and had breakfast at the Mahabodhi rest house nearby. And then we came back, had lunch, went back again at 4 o'clock and stayed there till the temple closed at 8, 9 o'clock. So just spent the whole day down there. And we did a little bit of practice together. And I gave a talk at each of the places where the Buddha had spent time. Did some puja under the tree in various places. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. Just living in the Mahabodhi temple. And it's a very strange experience. Anybody been to Bodh Gaya? It's quite shocking to begin with because, it's quite unpleasant. Bihar is one of the poorest places on earth. Indian tourism anywhere is the most vulgar and crude of affairs, and in Bihar, because it's one of the poorest places on earth, it's worse than ever. I mean, beggars, you can't imagine. I saw far worse this time than I've ever seen before. Really turns your stomach, and then tears your heartstrings, and you don't know what to do with your pocket. Quite a sort of thing you have to get used to, just dealing with the terrible conditions under which people are living. And I know a lot of the background because a lot of them are Dalits. And then in the temple itself, there's quite a lot of very unpleasant, crude sort of tourism, insensitive. It's a Hindu holy site. It's a place on the Shraddha. In other words, when somebody's died in a family, it's one of the places you visit. And it's just mechanical, people going, you know, racing round and racing off. And then all the different ethnic groups of Buddhism that come, and they're quite insensitive often. I know the first time I went there, I just couldn't connect with it really at all. You know, I had such strong expectations of being there. But I just couldn't really connect. I managed to work out how to be at Bodh Gaya. I decided I'm going to write a book about this, how to go on pilgrimage to Bodh Gaya. After a while you just tune in, and spending all that time there, you kind of tune into something underneath. Oh yeah, we had the official Communist Party Chinese Bhikshu Sangha who took over the space underneath the Bodhi tree, with huge banners which just completely cut off the whole area. And these enormous speakers, I don't know how they managed to hear anything. I think they were all deaf after a few hours or whatever. Turned up really high. It's awful. And they set it up, and I was with our gypsy friends from Hungary, who of course know all about the communist regime. They said it was just like a communist party conference, you know, rows of people sitting behind tables. Anyway, just to show you how awful it was. And on the last evening, I went there and I sat inside the parikrama, the walkway around the temple, right at the foot of the Bodhi tree. And suddenly about 100 Burmese turned up. And they were really rough. Very nice, very friendly, but really rough. They're very like Tibetans. They're quite similar sort of ethnic groups. So they've got the same kind of mixture of crudity with extraordinary devotion and feeling. So they were sort of cramming all around us. And they wanted to be closer up and they wanted to be together. So we moved aside. They were very grateful. Mm-hmm. We moved right up to the railing. So I was sitting with my nose 6 inches from the railing. And I could see through into the area under the tree, which I'd never really sort of focused on before. there's the tree, there's the temple, and between the tree and the temple, inside this very enveloping railing, there's a slab which comes from Ashoka's time, which marks the spot on which allegedly the Buddha sat. Whether it's exactly there, it's quite close to there at least. And I was sitting there just sort of looking through at it, and around me these Burmese chanting very, very roughly, but with tremendous devotion. So sort of a mixture of an aesthetically unpleasant experience and a devotionally powerful one. The Chinese doing a sort of souped-up country and western to Chinese gongs. Sri Lankans going around in long procession. They were offering a huge, long, gold lame robe to the Buddha. And they had loudspeakers every now and again. And they were chanting, believe it or not, the Tiratanavandana. This distorting loudspeaker, all out of phase. And, you know, I thought, I'm going mad. And at the same time, looking through at this place where there's a slab, just a slab, and nothing on it. There's a canopy over it. And I was sitting there with Dhammacharini Srimala, and she said something like, I can't believe that the Buddha gained enlightenment there. And with all that racket. I sort of looked through and I thought, well, yes, it's incomprehensible. What happened there is incomprehensible. And as soon as those sort of words came into my mind, and I sort of fully accepted the incomprehensibility of what happened there, a great surge of devotion. And the words that kept coming into my mind, almost like a mantra, was, my place is at your feet. My place is at your feet, which is a refrain from a poem by Bhante. And it's the incomprehensibility of the Buddha's enlightenment. What happened to him is beyond our comprehension, because it's not intelligible in rational terms. It's a transformation took place in him that took him beyond us. And the incomprehensibility of it is what one has to come to terms with. Once you realise that something did happen, that's what you get at Bodh Gaya, because there is the place where it happened, and it's fairly well attested historically that somewhere there, within, you know, 2 yards this way, 2 yards that way, that's where it happened. That's where he sat, and that's where he gained enlightenment. So you've got that, you know, fact of it, the sort of overwhelming facticity of it, almost sort of overpowering fact of it. And at the same time, the space is empty, so that the incomprehensibility of what happened at least came home to me. And in that, recognizing the incomprehensibility, I felt something like this: Uttamangena vandehang padapansu varuttamang. I just want to put my head at your feet. I just want to serve what you are. The other thing about it was that it's strange that the absence, the space, the historical space was there, but there was nothing there. It was far more expressive than if there had been a figure there. Far more expressive. And I don't think I've ever really appreciated the reality of the Buddha's attainment. And the reality of his presence in my life, even now. That in a certain sense, historically speaking, of course, the Buddha died, attained parinirvana. But I'm here because of him. His attainment is still echoing, is still ringing And yes, my place is at his feet. So that, I think, is what's connoted here. My place is at his feet. He is everything that's been summed up here. Tibiso Bhagava Arahant. It's that incomprehensible transcendence that took place there 2,500 years ago that we are heirs to, and that is our goal, our destiny, even. And but if you really understand what it is, what he attained, then your place is at his feet. That's what these verses at the end here are indicating. Your place is at his feet. I hadn't meant to go into all of that, but anyway, I'm reserving it for Monday night. Anyway, I'll do it again. See if I vary the story.
I wonder if we have this in the version that we chant in the West.
I don't know. No, I don't know. It's quite commonly used in the Theravada world. Dhammashalin found this version on the on Narada Tara's website, and with Nyanamoni, or who was it? Anyway, somebody else. So it's quite well known. But in a way, it's sort of a striking addition, isn't it? It's a much more coming back down to me in relation to the Buddha, which is what I like about it. And I like particularly the way it's chanted in India, because that melody, once one gets it going, has quite a strong sort of emotional feel to it, devotional, emotional feel to it.
Why are we changing? Is it uniformity, or is there a move towards...
I just like it.
Oh, okay.
Not a change, exactly. See if it catches on.
Oh, okay.
Like I'm trying to get everybody to put their head at the Buddha's feet.
So it's not being introduced, because I got that impression that this was being introduced as the official...
No, I haven't that authority, unfortunately. I'm learning. That's why I'm studying Starling. Yeah, so. It would be a smaller but more devoted. I just want to make sure for the camera set it's good going.
And if we don't follow you, we end up in a gulag, isn't it?
Yeah. If you're lucky, man. The lucky ones went to the gulag. It's the Lubyanka Wall. Just that I wanted to study this part of it. I wanted to introduce that part and make that better known. I also think it's a much more lovely tune. I think it's a much more evocative way of chanting, much more attractive once you get the hang of it. It's a sort of dying fall, doesn't it? A minorish tone. And yes, I think it sort of draws out the mood of it better. I think the way we do it is a bit dull. There's some lovely... You hear some very beautiful chants. The Thais have a very beautiful way of doing it. I can't reproduce it now. So, yeah, this is not official... but it doesn't mean that you can't do it. If you like it, do it. It's official in India. And it's good to have that connection with what people do in India. So that's the Buddha Vandana. Ready for more? Dhamma Vandana?
Mm.
Okay. So, this is a little shorter. Let's just look for a little bit at the word Dhamma, because obviously that's the essence of the matter. When we're going for refuge to the Dhamma, what are we going for refuge to? And what is it that we're doing Vandana to here? the word is got a very complex range of meanings, and even in Buddhist studies you'll come across quite a range of different meanings, some of which you'll be familiar with from the Mitra study course, of course, the idea of a Dhamma as an object, a mental object. You get it in the Satipatthana Sutta, don't you? The Dhammanupassana, the awareness of Dhammas as mental events. So you've got this idea of a Dhamma as a quality or attribute. So the ten precepts that order members recite are referred to as the ten Dhammas sometimes. So the ten qualities, the ten attributes. So a Dhamma can mean even spiritual qualities. A Dhamma can mean a mental object, as in the Abhidhamma analysis of reality into varying numbers of basic constituents, sometimes called atomic, but that's not really the right thing. It's as it were, units of mental experience. But the commonest meaning, which does go back before Buddhism, is as the natural order of things, the underlying order of things, the cosmic order, the way things are, the fundamental pattern of things. This is in some ways one of the most important aspects of Dhamma, that when you use the word, you're talking about the way things really are. For instance, Pratichasamuppada is Dhammatar. It's in accordance with the way things are. Things are dependently arising. It's not a formulation, it's not a doctrine, it's a reality. It's the way things are, if you see what I mean. That everything arises in dependence on conditions. When those conditions change, it passes away. So, yes, Dhamma means the natural order of things. But then it means the teaching that gives expression to that natural order of things, the way things really are. So you could say that the Buddha's formulation of Pratichasamuppada is an expression of Dhamma as reality, and itself is Dhamma, because it's expressing that reality. Dhamma also can mean path, the path that you follow in order to attain Buddhahood. So you've got that sort of gradation. You've got the Dhamma, the meanings that are used here. Dhamma as the way things ultimately are, regardless of whether anybody's seen it or not, whether anybody's expressed it or not. Things are as they are. There's an underlying pattern, an underlying structure. Things are ordered. Niyamata. I've gone into this in that first of the recent papers on revering the Dhamma. It's the ultimate nature of things, the way things really are. Then it's those teachings that express the way things are. So when the Buddha teaches that everything is Pratichasamuppada, when he teaches that everything is anitya, anatta, and dukkha, this is Dhamma. He's giving expression to the way things are. That itself is Dhamma. But then Dhamma is also the way you practice in order to attain that understanding for yourself. So you got it? I hope that's not confused at all too much. So you could say that before the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, things still arose in dependence on conditions. Reality was reality, regardless of whether the Buddha had seen it or not, or anybody else had seen it or not. Once he'd sat under the Bodhi tree, he saw that reality, he saw Dhamma, and he then began to teach. He expressed that Dhamma. So the Buddha's teaching itself was Dhamma, the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma. And then he set out a path of practices and precepts that would enable one to realise that the meaning of that Dhamma for oneself. Got it? So it's, in a sense, all of that that one is going for refuge to. There's an additional twist to this that I've talked about in that paper on revering the Dhamma. It's said that after the Buddha gained enlightenment, in fact the fifth week after his enlightenment, the place where this took place is marked at Bodh Gaya, he's sort of assimilating the experience that he's had. You get that strong impression that he had this overwhelming experience that liberated him from all kleshas, all suffering, completely free. He's seen the true nature of things. He's understood the conditioned nature of things. Once you've seen the conditioned nature of things, you understood there's nothing you can cling to. So once he let go of clinging, he experienced liberation. Then he went through in the succeeding weeks a sort of process of assimilation and a digestion of what he'd experienced. First of all, very strong feelings of gratitude arose in him. Gratitude to him, interestingly, towards the tree. He's said to have looked at the tree for a week. It's a lovely detail, isn't it? He just gazed at the tree with, according to tradition, unblinking eyes. And worshipping the tree, in gratitude to the tree for having sheltered him. And you can imagine in a way that the tree came to represent everything that had aided him, everything that had supported him, everything that assisted him. So it's very interesting that the first impulse of enlightenment is gratitude, and gratitude towards the humblest of supports that he'd received. Well, a tree is a magnificent thing, the Bodhi tree is an even more magnificent tree than most, but nonetheless, it's a tree. But the Buddha felt that sort of overwhelming gratitude to it, so he just sat and gazed at it. Then he walked up and down beside the Mahabodhi temple. You can see the place where he did that. And what is said is happening there is he's sort of digesting, exploring, trying to kind of put into words, beginning to try to find words to express what he'd seen, what he'd understood. Maybe for his own sake as much as anything at this point, not really thinking so much of explaining to anybody else, but digesting the experience, fitting it into place. Then he sat, as I told you this morning, in the Ratnagar, experienced a sort of exploration of the entire reality. And then he sat under a tree, it's at the foot of those steps coming down to the Mahabodhi temple. There's a pillar there. And he sat at the... there was a tree there. He sat under that tree, the Ajapala tree. And he's sort of still musing on the experience. And he's thinking to himself, well, you know, what do I do now? Who do I look to? What do I look to? The sutta... in which this is mentioned, in two suttas which mention it, but he says that to live without reverence, without reliance on something, is suffering. Garava is the word for reverence, nisayati, for to rely on. If you can't look up to something, if you can't rely on something, it's suffering. Which is, again, a very, very important message for all of us, living in such a flat culture where there's nothing to look up to that can sustain a good hard look. It does mean that you become the measure of everything. And my goodness, if we're the measure of everything, it's pretty small. So the Buddha is acknowledging that even he, even in this enlightened state, even in this liberated state, needs to have some sense of, insofar as he's still got a human body, something that is he's putting himself at the service of, that he's relying upon. And so he says, well, it can't be another human being. So there's nobody who's more ethical than me. There's nobody who has a stronger or deeper meditative experience than me. There's nobody who has a deeper understanding than me. So what can I rely on? And he said, well, the only thing I can rely on is the Dhamma. So Dhamma here just clearly doesn't mean the teaching, in the sense of, you know, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths and so forth. They didn't exist yet. He hadn't thought up, he hadn't started teaching. So there was no teaching. So what is it he's relying upon? Well, in a way, we have to say it's incomprehensible. We can't say, because it's a transcendental realization, transcending our rational minds. What he's relying upon is Dhamma as the fundamental nature of things. The fundamental nature of things, in the sense especially of that we see in the context of the Niyamas, if you've read my paper. Well, I talked about it at the LBC last time, or the time before. The Dhamma Niyama. Set of processes within reality, within the overall context of reality, that lead inevitably, naturally, spontaneously to Buddhahood. There is implicit in reality something that moves on to enlightenment. So the reality is so constructed that within it there is a pressure, a process that moves on to enlightenment. But in a way, perhaps we shouldn't sort of put too many words in this space. What the Buddha saw, what he realized that he had to rely on, insofar as he was a human being still, with a human body and a human mechanism, a human will even, that human will needs to be put at the service of the fundamental principle of things, this cosmic order that once it attains its full expression is enlightenment itself, is liberation, is freedom. So this is something of what we're going for refuge to. It's not merely a set of teachings. It's what those teachings are getting at, something that's beyond the reach of reason, beyond the reach of words, beyond the reach of definition, and that once we're able to deliver ourselves up to it, ineluctably good. It cannot but take us on to our greatest benefit and the greatest benefit of all. In the larger context, in the language of later Buddhism, it's what animates the bodhicitta. It's that force that underlies the bodhisattva's life. So, yes, this is what we are, what the Buddha, in a sense, you could say, goes for refuge to. In a sense, you could say the Buddha goes for refuge to the Dhamma. Still a human being, still got a human body, a human lives within space and time. Space and time have an orientation, so that orientation needs to be oriented. And it's oriented towards the Dhamma, from the Dhamma, by the Dhamma. So, yes, the Dhamma Vandana is ultimately aimed at the fundamental nature of things. But how do we rely upon the Dhamma? We may have some glimpse of a glimmer of a faint taste and a small smell, as it were, of the Dhamma as the cosmic order and law. We may get some inkling of it. That would be our samaditi, our samyak drishti, our perfect vision that's probably motivated all of us to be here. I'm telling somebody about my drug-soaked days and, you know, under the influence of certain substances, I certainly do remember touching on something of this kind. I'm not suggesting that anybody takes it. I did also rot my brains. So, yes, please don't misunderstand me. Probably everybody here is here because you've had some sort of glimpse of what goes beyond, and you want more of that. That's why you come here. I hope you've at least felt that you're moving closer towards it. We're going for refuge to that. But how do we know about that? How are we going to bring ourselves closer to it? How are we going to stabilise it in our lives, make it grow in our lives, move to the point at which we can let it take over? We can do it in one or two ways. We can keep on by trial and error, and maybe in the fullness of many, 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 many lifetimes, we might get there. Or we can put ourselves in contact with somebody who we are convinced has realised that, convinced enough, effectively convinced, if you like, we can't be yet really convinced, but effectively convinced, has realised that, and we sort of open ourselves up to that person, and we try to understand their expression of what they've understood. We put ourselves under their instruction. We offer ourselves to be tamed by them. And, we follow the path that they set out. So, for us, going for refuge to the Dhamma can only be fleetingly from time to time and maybe a little theoretically or in memory, going for refuge to the Dhamma as a transcendent principle. Most likely it's going to be for us mainly a going for refuge to that transcendent principle as expressed by, well, for us as Buddhists, the Buddha, who expressed it in such clear and unambiguous terms. And in putting ourselves under his train, following the steps that he set forth. Yeah? So... we go for refuge to the Buddha Dhamma. The Buddha goes for refuge to the Dhamma Dhamma, if you like, to the Dhamma as a transcendent principle. If we go for refuge to the Buddha's Dhamma, his teaching and his practice, his path, the path that he's set out, hopefully that will lead us to realise for ourselves the Dhamma that he saw and that he taught from. Yep, so this is what the subject of our Dhamma Vandana is. So let's see what we're committing ourselves to, aspiring to commit ourselves to, what we're singing the praises of. So it's Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo. So Bhagavata Dhammo. This makes the point clear. It's the Dhamma of the Bhagavad. The Dhamma of the Buddha, the Dhamma of the one who we've already heard about. We're following the teachings of that particular individual. We are going in for refuge ultimately to the Dhamma as principle, but we're going for refuge to the Dhamma specifically as the teachings of this particular individual. And that teaching of the Buddha is Svakato. Just by the way, just to go back to that, this is why it's so important for us to have a strong sense of the Buddha. We're talking a little bit over supper about the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They are very, very important because they give us more of an idea of what the Dhamma as principle is, if you see what I mean. They let us enter more into the imaginative realm of the Dhamma. But we come to know of that, and we come to be able to enter that because of the historical Buddha, because he got there and taught us about it. This is why it's so important that we do have a strong feeling for the Buddha, which doesn't deny the importance of the archetypal. In fact, it increases the importance of the archetypal as an expression of what he was. This is where they connect. So, yes, we're going for refuge to the Dhamma as a principle, but we're going for refuge to it through the Dhamma as expressed by the Buddha. This actually comes out in the Gaudiya Sutta. In the sutta, after the Buddha has said, "I'm going for refuge to the Dhamma," reverencing and relying upon the Dhamma, the god Brahma Sahampati appears and said, "Well done, well done. This is what all the Buddhas of the past have done." And then he sings a sort of a song, as he always does, and he sings something like, "All the Buddhas of the past have relied upon and revered the Dhamma. His followers revere his teaching." So this is the situation we're in. This is what the Dhamma Vandana is getting at here. And it's Svakato. Sva is a particle which is connected, which is the same as Su again. It means here well. Akato is communicated, spoken. So it's well expressed. The Buddha has expressed the Dhamma in very clear, as clear as it's possible to get, terms. He's delineated the limits of the sayable. Whatever can be said, he has said about the nature of things. Of course, it can be said in different ways, but he said the essence of it. And he said it well. He said it intelligibly, sensibly, reasonably, in terms that it's possible, even without great, highfalutin education and so forth, to understand. Very simple, uneducated people understand the words of the Buddha, even about the most profound things. And very highly intelligent and well-educated people often can't understand it at all. PhDs in Buddhology and they can't understand a word of it. And I've seen this in India. I've illiterate friends who have a very, very clear grasp of the fundamentals of the Dhamma. I remember once when I was first getting involved in ordinations in India, giving ordinations in India, trying to get to grips with a completely different culture and different mentality through a language I didn't speak and just completely different way of looking at things. And we realised that people were coming up for ordination and really didn't know much Dhamma very well. So Subhadra and I decided to do a sort of Dhamma test. And we had those who were being recommended up one by one and we asked them, what are the Buddha's seven noble truths and that sort of thing, trick questions like that. I remember a talk once we were weeding out the sheep from the goats and one chap came in and said, "I don't know anything. All I know is cease to do evil, learn to do good and purify your mind." I said, "Okay, you're in." He's illiterate, uneducated, but he knew what he needed to know. And he was putting it into practice. That was all he needed. So the Dhamma doesn't have to be complicated. The Buddha had it, put in terms that everyone could relate to. It's well communicated, and it is striking. I do dip in the Pali Canon a lot, extraordinary the things you come up with, like the five ways to answer a question. They're so sensible. They're not particularly dhammic, if you know what I mean, in the sense of to do with the ultimate nature of things, but just real common sense. Naturally, I can't remember what they are. That was one of the ways you answer a question. and then really simple profundities. He's an extremely good communicator in a way that a lot of it still works, some of it doesn't. but a lot of it still works. So, yes, the Buddha taught the Dhamma in a very clear way. The whole of the Buddhist tradition from then on, it's very easy, if you put a little bit of effort into it, just to work it back, you can see quite easily how, what Shinran taught sort of comes out of what the Buddha taught. And it's a sort of amplification of it, and so on. So, yes, it's well communicated. He'd understood the Dhamma, he understood people, and he got it across very, very well, very clearly. And something that, you know, one does spontaneously feel when you read the Dhamma and you get a sense that this is the truth speaking. And I often find a very strong sense of appreciation for its skill in communication. Then it's sanditiko. You can recognize ditti as in drishti, seen. And sun is a prefix which is the equivalent of the Latin con that we get in communication, contact, etc. So it's seen together. And the way this is understood is that it's to hear the Dhamma is to see its truth. Not just see it in the sense of intellectually see it, but as soon as you see it, as soon as you put it into practice, you realise its truth. For instance, you are taught that if you develop positive mental states, you will experience the karmic consequence of that in improved well-being and so on. So you develop metta bhavana, you call up the states of metta bhavana, and you feel happier, you feel better, etc. If you can really see the conditioned nature of things for even a moment, you feel a bit of freedom. You can feel a little bit of sense that it's not worth holding on to things just for a little bit. So the understanding is accompanied by a degree of direct realization. It's immediately apparent. It's visible. It's not something you have to wait for till later. Of course, you have to actually understand it. You have to actually see it, and you have to actually practice it. But if you do that, you will see the truth of it. It's not a believe and you will see the truth later sort of true teaching. Yes, so it doesn't rely on... the results are attainable by practicing, by putting it into practice, putting it into effect. It's akaliko. Kali is modern Indian languages, means time. It's a very confusing thing, but the word for tomorrow and the word for yesterday are both kali. You get into a lot of trouble over that unless you get the right tenses. But it means, the time tomorrow, the time yesterday. So akaliko means, is a negative prefix, means beyond time, without time, timeless. So wherever you are, whatever the circumstances, the Dhamma is the Dhamma. It's independent of circumstances. Yes, it remains true, independent of circumstances. Well, the Buddha himself says, whether a Buddha arises or whether a Buddha does not arise, one thing is certain, independence on this, that arises. In other words, the truth of conditionality is the truth of conditionality. It's not something the Buddha has made up. It's something the Buddha has discovered and expressed. So the Dhamma is always the Dhamma, whether anybody's realized it or not. And that's the sense you get when you get a bit of an insight into the Dhamma to any degree. You get a feeling, oh yeah, of course, that's always been there, it's always been the case. That sort of experience. You often get that sort of sense. So sometimes on a retreat you can get a very strong feeling of the truth of the Dhamma, and it's accompanied by a sense of kind of, well, it was there all the time. Sometimes in the Zen tradition they talk about selling water by the river. You know, a Dhamma teacher is sort of selling you water when actually you're living by the river all the time. The river of the Dhamma is always flowing. So in this sense, and this may be touching on our conversation this morning, the Dhamma is not Buddhist, if you see what I mean. The Dhamma is simply the nature of things. So you could say that in that sense, Buddhists don't have a monopoly of the Dhamma. The Dhamma is simply there for those that have eyes to see it. What is unique about the Dhamma, from the Buddhist perspective, is the clarity with which that is expressed and the unambiguousness of its expression, and especially its philosophical clarity and its middle way between eternalism and nihilism. Praticca Samuppada being the operative middle term there, the middle way. So yes, the Dhamma is not a Buddhist monopoly, in the sense of an institutional monopoly. It's not a truth that we have that other people don't have. Well, we, for a start, haven't got it yet. And other people may also have glimpses of it, Buddhists, non-Buddhists, others too. It's there for the having. I recently had occasion to look into William James' Varieties of Religious Experience, and one of the most inspiring things there is a policeman in Yorkshire who does his job in a village, the village plod. And in the evening he walks back to his village across the moors, and it describes his experience, and so much of it is about seeing the conditioned nature of the world around him. In completely unsophisticated terms he's speaking, but very plain, very simple, very straightforward. To what extent that was insight with a capital I, I'm not in a position to say. But there's certainly some flavour of a perception of something very like the Dhamma. It's there for the having. The Dhamma, in a sense, well, it's just, if you open your eyes, you can see it. The problem is the way in which you stabilise that. And this is where the difficulties arise. And this is a lesson for us as an institution. You need to be careful that the institution doesn't begin to deny what it's established to bring about, if you see what I mean. That's what happens to all institutions, you know. Again, reading about Stalin. I'm sorry to go on about Stalin. But, you know, the communist ideal is a very lofty one in many ways. But the way in which it was instituted, because of the fundamental contradictions within its conception, is horrific. Horrific on to a degree that I hadn't realised even, though I knew quite a lot about it. One has to be always careful that the institutions that one sets up, the systems and so forth, serve the ultimate purpose. And remain open to a truth that, in a sense, is always beyond us. Even if, as I do, believe that the Buddha had a unique place in history, I know that I don't. If you see what I mean. And I have yet to realise that for myself. So I hope a proper degree of humility is with us all. So yes, it's akaliko, it's beyond time. It's not to do with any particular formulation, any particular institution, any particular body of people, etc. The Buddhism as an institution or a set of institutions is only valuable to the extent that it does enable people to connect with, contact the Dhamma as a kaliko, as a timeless truth. And one has to be honest about it throughout history. At times it has, and at times it hasn't. At times it's done the opposite. At the times it's just become another conventionality. At times it's become perhaps something worse. Fortunately, not quite as bad as some others. Bhante says, doesn't he, that every religion has its besetting sin. The besetting sin of Christianity is intolerance, of Islam is fanaticism, Hinduism is inhumanity, and Buddhism is laziness, which is perhaps a better sin than intolerance and so forth, but it's a sin nonetheless, because in a sense laziness means that you're also denying people a benefit. So yeah, it's akaliko. It's not a particular form of words, even though the words are attempting to express it. Whatever the Buddha said is an attempt to get you to see something which, in a sense, he can never fully capture in words. It's not that the Buddha, that the truth cannot be expressed, but it cannot be expressed in a way that avoids all possibility of misunderstanding. Do you see what I mean? Anything that is said may express the truth, but the problem is that it's always possible for the human mind to distort what's heard and turn it into something that's not meant. So it's akaliko. It's ehipasiko. It's lovely. The ehi means come. Pasiko means see. Come see. So Bhante translates it as of the nature of a personal invitation. Which is very interpretive. But it captures the meaning quite nicely. You sometimes get that experience, don't you? You're talking to somebody and they want to know about Buddhism. And in the end you have to say, well, come and try it. Come on a retreat. Come and meditate. Come and see for yourself. Don't take my word for it. Come and see. You can say that with a fair degree of confidence. You're fairly confident that people, if they do actually sit down and focus their minds, they'll sort of see what you're getting at. Or if they really do sort of look hard at a teaching like Pratitya Samuppada, they'll see what it means. So it's a teaching that invites you to see for yourself. Again, this is extremely important. It doesn't say, this is what it is, this is the truth, take it, believe it. It says, well, this is what the Buddha teaches, now come and try it. Suck it and see. See whether it really works for you. And you have to say, well, if it doesn't work for you, what can I say? I can't tell you it does. It doesn't mean that there may not be some factor on their side that is inhibiting them, but that's another question. So it's ehipasiko, come and see. It's opanayiko. Nayaka means to lead. Isn't that one of the that's in the Sangha Vandana. We'll see it there again. Naya means to lead or to order, and here it means opa is a prefix meaning forward, so it leads you onward. When you become engaged with the Dhamma, you come and see it, you get a little bit of a flavour, but you want to go further. You've got to go further. It leads you on to the next step. You practice ethics. You find that ethics develops your mind in a new way. Your mind emerges in a new way. You begin to experience yourself in a new way, and that new way of experiencing yourself implies a deeper concentration. deeper concentration itself implies a penetration of the ultimate nature of things. So it's step by step, that's another way you could put it. Each step sort of guides you on to the next. It's quite striking, Bhante quotes, isn't he? Krishnamurti, people saying of Krishnamurti, we've been listening to your teaching for so many years, but we're not really changed, because of course Krishnamurti was protesting against the literalism of his own background and the literalism of the theosophy that he'd been recognised as the Messiah in. But undoubtedly his teaching is at a very lofty level indeed from many points of view, certainly from a theoretical point of view. But it's very difficult to put into practice. There's no path implied in it. Maybe there is, but certainly what I've understood. You find that in a number of different contexts. But you do get some glimpses of reality opened up, but you don't know what to do with it. You don't know how to get there. I remember this myself with those LSD experiences, just sort of catching a glimpse of the nature of things, having no idea what to do next. I could see the truth, but what on earth to do? And in fact, it then tends to go the other way, and it falls into a sort of depression, because you can see that ordinary life is kind of not where it's at. You can see what really is, but you've no idea how to close the gap. So the Buddha shows you both the ultimate and the steps that are required to take towards it. That's the Dhamma. Dhamma as doctrine, Dhamma as method, which the Buddha unfolds. He teaches you the way things really are, and he teaches you how to move progressively, step by step by step, towards it. This is something really wonderful about the Dhamma. It doesn't just tell you, I've seen this. I met a very, very interesting Hindu guru quite recently. He was quite anti-caste and so forth, and he was explaining to me his teaching, his insight, and they definitely got some sense that at least to some degree he'd seen something like what I understood the Buddha to be pointing at. There was some degree of transcendence there, albeit in a very complex sort of theoretical framework, but very difficult to say how you would activate that. Sure enough, well, the main method was of devotion. And I could say more about that, but what the Buddha teaches is that from everybody, wherever you are, there's a step you can take that brings you towards the realization of the Dhamma. This is the wonder of Bhagavata Dhammo, that it's both ultimate and mediate, and it shows the means of closing the gap between the two. So we're praising it for that quality. Yes, so leading onwards, that's very important, progressive. There's a set of steps that go from where you are to where you're trying to get. And in a way, if you have some sort of perfect vision experience, whether chemically induced or not, sooner or later you're just going to have to come back to the regular steps of building the basis. You need a moral basis, you need an attuned mind, a tuned up mind, and you need a clarity of understanding. Then you can see, then you're able to let the Dhamma take you over. So then, Pachatang Veditabo Vinyuhiti. Pachatang is personally, Veditabo is again, this route to see, to be known here. Vinyuhiti, those who are wise, those who know. It's to be seen personally and by the wise. So the point here is that it's not something that you can fully understand. You cannot penetrate the Dhamma in the highest sense without having taken the steps to get there. You can get some glimpse, and you can get some strong intuition, but you cannot fully penetrate it unless you have wisdom. Which is virtually saying you cannot penetrate it until you penetrated it. You've got to take the steps and get there. And it has to be done pachatam, personally. You cannot do it vicariously. Nobody else can do it for you. Please, can you go and gain enlightenment for me? Send a text message to Dhammashala, can you gain enlightenment for me? My secretary. You can't do that. You've got to do it yourself. The Dhamma is to be known individually and only by wisdom. It's not a common sense thing. You sometimes get this sense, don't you, that you try and explain something of the loftiest dimension of the Dhamma to somebody, and you just have no way of getting it across to them because they're looking from quite the wrong point of view. They're still looking from a narrowly materialist point of view, from a this life point of view. So you've got no sort of basis, but you can only really begin to communicate the richer, deeper dimensions of the Dhamma when people have some openness, some flexibility, some beginnings of wisdom. So in the end, the Dhamma is to be known by the wise. So we've got a very full definition here. The Dhamma is a teaching. It's a teaching that is clear, accurate, as unambiguous as it's possible for words to be. Doesn't mean that it cannot be misinterpreted, but that it leaves as few hostages to misunderstanding as possible. It's visible, it's apparent. When you understand it, you see it. When you practice it, you experience it. It's timeless. It's something beyond any particular expression, any particular form. It's always true, everywhere true. It's an invitation. It invites you to come and see. Invites you to taste it for yourself. You cannot just leave it as a theoretical exposition. You have to get into it, see it for yourself. And it leads you onwards. Once you begin to engage with it, it takes you forward. And it's to be seen individually, and it's to be seen with wisdom, with deep wisdom. So this is what you're going for refuge to when you go for refuge to the Dhamma. You're going for refuge to the Buddha Dhamma, but that Buddha Dhamma is a particular expression of something that is beyond time, and that is capable of being expressed again and again and again, perhaps in different systems that will be expressed in different ways. It was teaching the Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutra talks about Buddhas who teach in all sorts of strange mediums, for instance with smells or perfumes. The Dhamma, you know, can take many, many different forms according to the natures of the individuals, the beings. So this is what you're going for refuge to, and you are saying that you go for refuge to it as long as the span of your life lasts. It's all the Dhammas of the past, because wherever Buddhas have arisen, Dhammas have arisen. The timeless truth, the one truth, the Sanatta Dhamma, is expressed again and again by those who fully attain it. So all of those Dhammas that Buddhas of the past have expressed, you go for refuge to them. All the Dhammas of the future, you will go for refuge to them. All the Dhammas of the present, you will go for refuge to them. And salute them. You do vandana to them. There's no other refuge than this. no other teaching, only those teachings that express the timeless truth of the Dhamma will be your refuge. The Dhamma for me is the supreme refuge. By the virtue of his truth, may grace abound in victory. Then you say, Uttamangena Vandeham, saluting with my head. I salute with my head. The Dhamma, the supreme twofold Dhamma, Duli Dham Varam, the supreme twofold Dhamma, the Dhamma of doctrine and method, the Dhamma that teaches you the ultimate nature of things and teaches you the way to the ultimate nature of things. And Dhamme yo kalitodoso, if I have in any way breached my connection with the Dhamma, may the Dhamma keep going with me. If you see what I mean. So that may the Dhamma still be there. But of course it will be. But by expressing that, you make it there for you. So you reconnect with the Dhamma. So there you are. That's the Dhamma Vandana.